From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Many Westerners have heard how the textile facilities that produce the inexpensive clothes they love generate problems around the world, including environmental damage and hazardous working conditions. You may not have heard as much about leather. That industry also has a dark side. Today we hear from a writer and a photojournalist who have produced a moving series on leather production in the United States, as well as a notoriously unregulated neighborhood in the capital of Bangladesh.
Some of the workers couldn't open their hands unless they were wet with chemicals, because they're constantly bathed 8, 10, 12 hours a day, you know, in these chemicals, so their hands would be pliable. As soon as their hands dried, their skin would crack.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. For a long time, we've heard about the problems our love of cheap clothing causes around the world. Problems like lax environmental and safety regulations and child labor. Today, we're going to zero in on an industry you may not have heard as much about, leather. A riveting four-part visual tour of textile and tannery industries around the globe recently appeared in the online magazine Undark. We plan to focus on the tannery portion. Freelance journalists Debbie and Larry Price produced the series with the support of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Both are former Baltimore Sun staffers, and both have joined me from a studio near their home near Dayton, Ohio. Welcome to On the Record.
Hi,
glad
thanks.
To be here.
Thanks very much.
I'd like to devote the first part of the show to Hazarabagh, the neighborhood in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, where you reported on leather tanneries. Larry, describe the working conditions there.
Well, in this area of Dhaka, this is actually it's a district, so you have, you know, 150 to 200 of these leather tanning operations in this tiny little space. The thing I always impressed me about Hazarabagh is that you smell it long before you get there. I mean, you can imagine Bangladesh with so much traffic, so many people, 16 million people in that city. So you have all of these odors, traffic, diesel fuel exhaust, but there's no mistaking when you get near Hazarabagh. You can smell this overpowering stench of rotting leather chemicals. And the thing about it is that the effluent from the factory products just flow through these open ditches, ultimately into this large canal that bisects the district. So you have millions upon millions of gallons of factory waste and chemicals that flow through these open ditches of the district. Ultimately, that flows into the nearby Barabinga River.
There is no treatment at all of this effluent?
No, none whatsoever. The leather tanning process, the effluent travels through the walls of the various factories into these small open canals, and then they go into ever larger canals, and then they end up in holding ditches. They just pollute the entire area. I mean, everywhere you walk, you know, you're stepping over little trenches running with this gray-green liquid that's the byproduct of the process.
Tell us more about what it looks like with your photographer's eye.
Well, the central area, as I talked about, was this large open canal that channels the effluent into the nearby river. And along this canal, you have children playing, you have traffic, you have rickshaws, you have the general hubbub of a dense urban environment, industrialized factory sounds and so forth. The thing that struck me were these massive piles of leather scraps. These are the leftover byproducts of the tanning process. These are ultimately sold themselves, you know, as a product. In some places, they're stacked 6, 7, 8 feet high. It's just amazing to see.
These photos are really both beautiful and kind of horrifying. I'm thinking of one with a worker sloshing through bright green chemicals, a solution that's used to remove hair and fat from animal hides, and he's barefoot. And I couldn't help but think what it must be doing to his own hair, skin, and fat. What was it like for you to shoot these photos?
That's the tragedy here, is that you don't have a lot of protection for the workers in the factories. Some of the lucky ones, they'll have their own boots or gloves to work with, but many times they just are working barefooted or with flip-flops in these chemical vats. And the chemicals are chromium compounds, basically, in strong alkalis, lime, other chemicals that are used to process the leather in various stages. But they cause all manner of issues with the workers. I mean, a lot of the workers complained of open sores on their hands and feet. Some of the workers couldn't open their hands unless they were wet with chemicals.
Couldn't open their hands unless they were wet because?
Well, because they're constantly bathed 8, 10, 12 hours a day, you know, in these chemicals, so their hands would be pliable. But as soon as their hands dried, their skin would crack.
How did you get such close access to shoot these photos?
You know, the access is always the problem, and it was just a matter of working with some of my contacts there and building a rapport with some of the workers. In some cases, we literally just walked into the tanneries and just struck up conversations with the managers and told them what we were doing. In other cases, we had to go through some official channels and get permission ahead of time. You know, I don't photograph workers who don't want to be photographed, so it's all about establishing a rapport and respecting who you're photographing and, you know, just spending the time to get to know the workers a little bit before you start photographing. After a while, they just forget you're taking pictures.
I just would have thought that the management of these operations would not have wanted Western photographer to be capturing the images.
That's the case. In many cases, it's true. We were turned away in many of the places, but I was there for 2 weeks. So going back each day and talking to different people.
Is there a particular moment from your reporting in Bangladesh that sticks with you?
Two things that was really difficult to watch, especially when you compare it to working conditions in North American factories. The workers working without protection and probably having very little real understanding of the damage that they're doing to their bodies. That was sort of a common theme. And also watching the children. Many of these factories had underage workers, and I'm talking children working who are 10, 11, 12 years old and working around heavy machinery and very, very dangerous industrial machines, you know, that were operating in close proximity.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with photojournalist Larry Price and his colleague and wife writer Debbie Price about their recent series in Undark magazine on the human and environmental costs of our love of leather. Debbie, how much of the leather in the world comes from places like Hazaribagh?
Bangladesh contributes a relatively small amount of leather to the world market. The global market is somewhere in excess of $200 billion, and they put about $1 billion into the world market. They produce about $1.5 billion, and then most of that is exported. So they're a small player in the world market compared to China or India or Brazil. But some of their leather does, in fact, find its way into products that are bound for America. And very small amounts of it comes directly to America.
Do you think that the kinds of conditions Larry saw there are typical of conditions in developing countries that produce leather?
Well, yes. And in fact, he also photographed tanneries in Tamil Nadu, India, where the conditions were very similar to those in Bangladesh. So it's a worldwide problem. And there are watchdog groups within the leather industry, the Leather Workers Guild. They monitor tanneries. And some of the more responsible companies will only buy leather from tanneries that are monitored and rated by the LWG. So that's part of it. But it happens a lot all over the world. And, you know, the more out of sight the tanneries are, the worse the conditions can be.
How much of the kind of leather production you were describing and photographing, how much of that comes to America, or how much of the leather that Americans buy comes from those places?
It's actually kind of hard to say, because when you buy your shoes or whatever, it will say where the product's made. For example, it might be made in China, but the company might be buying the leather for that shoe from Vietnam or Bangladesh or India. We looked at some shipping records by a company called Datamine. They're an aggregator. They collect shipping records. And we used those to determine which major companies in America were, you know, having their shoes actually produced in Bangladesh. And we talked to those companies, and all but one of them that we talked to actually cooperated and told us and said, well, yes, our shoes are made in Bangladesh, but our leather's not coming from Azerbaijan because we know the conditions are bad and we're buying it elsewhere. And in some cases, they gave us receipts and photographs of boxes to prove their points. But one of the larger companies didn't respond at all to our questions.
So is there a way for consumers in America to know whether or not a particular product is made from leather produced in these awful conditions?
Right now, no. Some of the companies have their sustainability statements online, and they will actually say where they get their leather. But most of the companies don't.
So if you really want to be careful about it, you should check online what kind of sourcing is done by the company whose shoes you're thinking of buying.
And that's very limited. Timberland and Clarks are some of the more transparent companies. And Puma has a sustainability statement, but they'll say, you know, we're not as good at getting the Tier 2 suppliers vetted as we'd like to be. And the Tier 2 are the ones that are producing the goods that go into the products. Timberland, for example, has shoes that are made at a company called Bay Footwear in Bangladesh. And they say, though, that they buy their leather for Bay Footwear from Prime Asia in Vietnam. Most of the companies are not that transparent. So it's very, very hard for consumers to know. And that's probably something that consumers should be asking more and asking the companies to tell them more and be more transparent about where the leather comes from.
Have you changed your own leather consumption habits since reporting this story?
You know, I'm not a real good consumer. My shoes are, the ones I'm wearing today are about 6 years old. So, but I did look at my daughter's shoes from one of these companies that we were writing about to see where they were made. And they were made in China, which didn't tell me a whole lot.
Larry, the Bangladeshi government has given tanners in Hazaribagh an ultimatum. They have until the end of March to move their operations to a new, supposedly cleaner industrial park. Your article notes that almost 14 years have passed since the Bangladeshi government announced plans to develop a cleaner industrial park for tanneries. Why is progress so slow?
I think there hasn't been the will, to be honest with you, and it's a very difficult thing to do, and money was in short supply. And there were court orders and largely ignored, but it has kind of reached a crisis level now. And I think one of the things that's propelling this forward is that the world is now a lot more aware of the conditions there, and a lot of companies are not buying leather, and they've seen their leather sales fall off. So, you know, the shaming of Bangladesh leather may be more effective at cleaning up the situation than the court orders have been.
One of the things also that you have to consider is the labor issue. You know, in the middle of Hazaribagh, the labor pool there is sufficient. And also the people who do the actual tanning work, that's somewhat technical because you're dealing with chemicals and precise processes, even though they're on a large industrial scale. But in the remote areas where they're trying to get the factories relocated, there's not a built-in labor pool. It's a short distance, but in some cases takes 2 to 3 hours to get there. So you can imagine, you know, every day you've got a 6-hour commute to work 8 hours. So that presents its own problem. A lot of the tanneries are very concerned about gearing up, and in some cases they insist that they're going to have a new labor force completely.
Well, how optimistic are you that there's going to be some kind of reform soon?
Well, they have a deadline of March 31st, and these deadlines have come and gone before. The one thing that seems to point toward more enforcement is that they had a deadline of January 31st to stop the wet processing. And from what we're hearing from our reports, that actually has happened, and more tanneries every month are moving out to Savar. So whether they extend this 31st deadline, they probably will. I'll guess they would. But more and more of the tanneries are moving. And I think ultimately they will move. It'll be a long time. And then there's a horrific pollution problem that remains. And in talking to Human Rights Watch, they don't know what Bangladesh will do to clean up this problem. And I think Bangladesh doesn't know.
It will happen. They are absolutely going to move eventually. And it's also worth noting that in India, specifically in Kolkata, they went through this process some years ago, and they actually did relocate the tanneries to a complex about 20 kilometers outside the center of Kolkata. And by and large, you know, that's worked. They have vast containment ponds where they treat the effluent, and it's mitigated a lot of pollution there.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, more from journalist Debbie Price and documentary photographer Larry Price. The couple recently produced a four-part series on the global textile and leather industries for Undark magazine. We're focusing on leather. When we come back, we'll talk about an American town that lost its thriving tanning industry to places like the Hazarabad neighborhood in Bangladesh. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On the Record. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the environmental and human health costs of the tanning industry. Journalists Debbie and Larry Price have produced a four-part series in Undark magazine that includes in-depth reporting on a heavily polluted tanning area in Bangladesh, as well as a depressed town in upstate New York that has lost its booming tanning industry to other countries. Debbie Price, tell us a bit about Gloversville, New York.
Gloversville is in upstate New York. It's a small town, about 15,000 people now. At one point, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was the absolute center of glove making pretty much for the world. At one point, they had over 100 tanneries and glove factories in Gloversville, which was named for the glove making. And beginning in probably the late 60s, early 70s, the glove making industry began to decline. And with it, the tannery industry began to decline. And then as recently as the early 1980s, when more environmental laws came into place that required the tanners to treat their own effluent, then that's when the tanneries really all shut down. Previously, they'd been pumping their effluent into the local rivers, just like it happens over in Bangladesh and in India. So they were basically forced to put in treatment facilities, and the tanneries that couldn't afford to do so just closed. And today there are very few left in Gloversville and Fulton County, which also includes Johnstown, New York. But Larry did photograph inside one of the tanneries, and I talked to the tanner whose father-in-law had weathered the storms and kept the place going. They're actually doing pretty well based on a niche business. So the businesses that are left in Gloversville have very specialized products and services, because they can't compete with the big volume.
And you write that Gloversville overall is having something of a comeback. It's got some businesses going, including leather businesses.
They're like a lot of towns in America that got hit pretty hard with manufacturing declines. And they're working very hard to bring back their economy with other kinds of industries. One of the ironies I thought was that, you know, the water was so polluted early in the 20th century that the Cayudutta River would foam up and it was horrible, but they've always had a lot of water. And now they've got really clean water, which is attracting industries like Faye yogurt and Euphrata cheese. So their water now is a major asset that they're using to bring in other kinds of industry.
You talked about the impact that regulation forcing cleanup of the tanneries in Gloversville had. It came at the same time, or what was the relationship of the timing with competition from offshore markets?
It was all kind of at the same time. The competition was first, really. The glove industry was really the first to go. The offshore markets attracted the glove making, and most of the glove factories moved offshore. And a lot of the tanning went offshore, too. So the tanners that had stayed were struggling with overseas competition and seeing their market share decline, and the environmental regulations, which were very necessary, but those environmental regulations were kind of the final straw for the ones that were struggling to stay in business.
And you write, quote, "Early offshore markets are facing their own Gloversville moments now," end quote. What do you mean by that?
In terms of Bangladesh, for example, they're facing a lot of competition at both ends of the market, at the high end from China and India, and at the lower end from emerging markets such as Vietnam. So they're facing competition in the market for leather, and they're facing a cleanup of their environmental issues. They're having to move to Savar. They're going to have to clean up. They're going to have water treatment plants. And at the same time, they're facing competition from other countries. So it's a moment of truth for them, just as it was for Gloversville, New York.
That's journalist Debbie Price here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. She and her husband, photojournalist Larry Price, produced a four-part series in Undark magazine of in-depth reporting on a heavily polluted tanning area in Bangladesh, as well as a depressed town in upstate New York. Your series sort of looks at both sides of globalization, the ravaged areas of Bangladesh, what's left in the town of Gloversville here in the U.S. What are your thoughts on globalization?
Well, one of the things one of the tanners said to me was, you know, the best thing we could export right now are our regulations and our technology to help make these other industries better and to require those other industries to play by the same rules that we do. In other words, to level the playing field. So that American products are competitive and so that these industries are not polluting their home countries. Globalization is a very big, complicated issue, as you know, and there are products that are not going to ever be made in the United States again in any great scale because of the cost of labor and because these industries have emerged in other parts of the world and they're thriving. As we saw in the course of this, is that our products here are going to be different. Our technology is going to be different. In the textile industry, they're developing new types of thread, and that's the future for American industry. The mass-produced stuff, it's going to be a long time, if ever, before you see much of that here again because of the conditions are and the labor markets.
One of the things that was really interesting is that to look at these niche markets, you know, that are coming back. The companies have really used a lot of ingenuity. For instance, there's a company called Samco, and, you know, they came into existence, I think, the late 90s, maybe the mid-90s, but Samco is thriving, and they fulfill most of the manufacturing for the U.S. military.
Gloves.
They make gloves for the U.S. military. That's most of their contracts. I photographed this woman. She was 91 years old. And she had been working 75 years in the glove industry. She started when she was in her mid-teens. And, you know, she knows everything there is about gloves. And she was sitting there 3 days a week. She came in, and she did a complete shift at Samco. It was just amazing. The tanners, you know, they're tanning alternative hides, you know, high-quality leather, deer skin, bison skin, you know, things of that nature. So, you know, there's a lot of ingenuity. A lot of American ingenuity that's helping that industry rebound in a clean way.
Debbie, when you talk about exporting U.S. regulations, why is there any reason to believe that other countries would be eager to receive U.S. regulations and embrace them?
Well, I think it begins with what we buy from those other countries. In other words, we can say, we want you, shoe company XYZ, to buy leather that's produced ethically and environmentally sound ways. And then this shoe company says to the leather company, we want you to do this in the right way, and here's the technology, here are the regulations we follow in America, and help them impose those so that they're not polluting, so that they recycle their water, so that their workers are wearing protective gear. So it begins with consumers saying, we want to know what's going into our products, and we want our products to be produced cleanly and fairly and safely. And then our government can also look at what sort of tariffs we apply and companies that are doing work overseas in countries that have good regulations and worker safety protections, they get a break on their tariffs. The ones that don't, pay more tariff. So there's a carrot and stick in there. And that's very simplistic, I know, but it's possible and it's happened before in many ways.
And not turning a blind eye, I mean, I just wanted to add that companies need to be on site. You know, that was one of the things that struck me in Hazaraban in Bangladesh, is that I didn't see a lot of evidence of Western inspection or people that presumably are buying these products. They need to be on site doing due diligence and making sure that the practices and procedures are done in a responsible way.
Debbie, sweatshops in the textile industry have made headlines for decades. Why do you think we haven't heard more about leather?
Well, there have been some very major events like Rana Plaza that called attention to the textile industry. And one of the things, too, Greenpeace has been very active in highlighting the textile industry and the chemicals they use and the abuses. And so they're a bit ahead of the leather industry in the whole cleanup process. People are more aware. They're demanding more of the companies that sell clothes in America. And so I think you're going to see, as people become more aware of what goes on in leather, I think you're going to see the same sort of thing happening.
One thing you have to have in the textile industry is that you have to have lots and lots of water, so that the factories tend to be in close proximity to rivers and waterways or canals. So, you know, that sets up a fairly bad dynamic from the beginning, because historically the wastewater and the chemicals are simply washed into the streams and rivers. Leather, it's possible to produce hides and go through the entire tanning process and still contain the effluent. So it doesn't necessarily demand as much water. And, you know, ironically, it has the potential to be somewhat cleaner in the production process.
That's interesting. I really appreciate your both walking us through this. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Debbie Price is a writer and freelance journalist. She's worked on the staff of the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun, among other publications. Larry Price is a Pulitzer Prize-winning documentary photographer who's also been on staff at numerous newspapers. We have links to their series on the global tanning and textile industries in Undark magazine at the On the Record page at wypr.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Please tune in again tomorrow.